Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the waving goodbye to Brian Courtney show.
Bye.
Because we are now going through producers so fast.
We can't seem to hire them.
They're out the door before we could even say goodbye. Brian's gone. Sorry about that.
Did he tell you he was leaving?
just we walk in, the room's locked, and I guess we didn't walk in with the room's locked.
You know, maybe this will force him to give us a key.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, we are.
I mean, you know what it's going to be? Before long, you know, you're going to be like, well, you'll do what you always do, but I'll be running the board.
You have dreams of running
and then,
everything. You
know, and then I will turn you down.
You have dreams of running everything.
I will turn you down.
Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. Our co-medical host, Shelly Irving, is on assignment in Isomville.
What'd you do with her?
I sent her to Isomville.
You lost the producer and you lost the...
Yes, we are huddled around the fire here. The lights are off, the sirens are sounding, and there are very few of us left. But there is one person left here, the Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure for the University of Kentucky, to tell you how to find us on the web, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get Health Matters. You can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. That's right. Moorhead State Public Radio has a website, WMKY.org. Log in. Find the menu, find Health Matters, jump over there. You'll see a list of the most recent shows. There's a link there with the audio. You can listen to them. They're in MP3 format. There's also a link to get to the podcast. And if you like having Health Matters delivered to you automatically about 4 days after the show airs the first time, then certainly sign up for that podcast. You can do so, again, there at the Health Matters page at WMKY.org. After that, it's time to interact with Health Matters. We have a Facebook fan page set up just for such an occasion. Log in. It's facebook.com/HMRadioShow. And again, it's a fan page. You can leave feedback. You can leave comments. You can post interesting news that you find. We certainly do the same. Sometimes we post things that are on the show. Sometimes it's just things that are interesting. And they catch your eye and you go, wow, Health Matters listeners would love to read about this.
Now, let me tell you about the Facebook page. I research the scientific literature. I post things about the future of healthcare. Rick posts this thing about you're better off swearing when you lift weights, and he gets 1,000 hits on that
but
thing.
But didn't you actually catch the last line? And people who swear are more intelligent. Research actually says it. I'm smarter than you. I know I cuss more than you. Although I have to believe when you're working on the farm, you have to yell out expletives to deal with the pain.
Well, if that were the case, I'd be yelling out expletives right now. So I won't give you that. Our sponsor.
But hey, it did get more hits than you.
I know.
And that's
more,
exactly
and
what that
really
fan page
annoys
is for.
Me.
That fan page is for interesting things, not just stuff Tony finds.
Our sponsor, Zika Virus Fun Facts. And this is where I do the dance of love. The CDC, they wish to speak a. Avoid mosquitoes and don't get Zika. We've got our top 8 Zika fun facts for you because it is, once again, Zika season in the Gulf Coast. The Zika virus is a flavivirus. It can be challenging to separate from dengue and chikungunya, Rick's favorite virus, chikungunya. Put a little bit of sauce on that, and it makes an excellent meal. The Zika virus is spread, fun fact number 2, by the Aedes species, Aedes aegypti, and also Albopticus. My sources say that they bite mostly during the daytime. I checked the CDC website. They said they can bite at any time. If you travel to an area of active Zika infections, you must avoid these mosquito bites. Insect repellents with DEET, Picaridin, or IR3535 are safe during pregnancy and at other times, and in low concentrations are fine for your children as well. Mosquito nets at night, stay indoors or stay behind screens when you go to the Gulf Coast. Fun fact number 3, symptoms are mild. 80% of people infected with Zika virus have no symptoms. If you do have symptoms, it's fever, joint aches, rash, and sometimes some dry eyes. Symptoms last less than a week. Hospitalization, very rare. But if you are pregnant and you get Zika infection, there is a condition called microcephaly. About 10% of the time will affect your baby. And this is devastating. Severe brain defects, severe developmental delays and a lifetime of dismay, I'll put it that way, for you and the baby. So this Zika virus is the real deal, and if you are pregnant, you must avoid it at all costs. As best we can tell, once someone has been infected with Zika virus, it is likely they'll be protected from future infections, and there is no evidence that a past Zika infection increases the risk of birth defects in future pregnancies. I'll stop at fun fact number four. The CDC recommends that all pregnant women consider postponing travel to areas in which transmission of Zika virus remains active. It is currently most prevalent in Central America and South America. However, last year there was transmission in the state of Florida of the Zika virus. I know the Floridians don't like that. We've already angered the citrus people. We will make the rest of Florida mad. We will tell you, if you are pregnant, Health Matters recommends you not travel to the Gulf Coast and particularly not travel to Florida, because we know there have been mosquitoes with the Zika virus in them in the state of Florida. That's our sponsor, Zika Virus Fun Facts. Hang on, Rick. Clear the table. The CDC, they wish to speak. Avoid mosquitoes and don't get Zika. You know, I just love that. It's one of the best slogans we have had.
You know, that never gets new.
It brings it home to me, and I do enjoy presenting Zika. What do you think about smell?
I'm glad you're 3 feet away.
May 15th, the journal Science. Maybe we have been underestimating human beings' sense of smell.
You think?
Yeah, because my dog can eat absolutely anything.
Right.
And sometimes they throw up. If my dog has such a great, sensitive sense of smell, why don't they ever smell something and get sick? Because I certainly smell. I mean, even as a physician, I have smelled stuff that made me sick.
Okay.
You haven't?
Well, I'm not a physician.
I know, but you smelled stuff.
Well, of course I have. We've all had babies. I mean, you know, I've had kids at the house, and, you know, there's all kinds of
I like this thing. Babies, you know, that stench of babies.
Well, I mean, they have their aroma at times.
Fair enough. But the interesting thing about it, we've always been told we have a poor sense of smell. You know, those dogs and things,
well,
they can smell anything.
It's a poor sense of smell that's relative to other creatures.
But that's wrong, too.
Is it?
Yes.
How do you know?
Because
I have the scientific
research, and I'm going to read it if you'll keep. Just keep quiet for
a few minutes.
Nearly 150 years ago, there's a neurosurgeon named Paul Broca, and he's got an area of the brain named after him. That's my goal. I want an area of the brain, a serious area of the brain named after me.
Oh, no. You said you threw the serious in just a little too late.
Yeah, I know, but I do want
You're
a serious
You're going to get the part that controls the earlobe.
Well, this is the fascinating thing. Broca was under pressure from the Catholic Church to distinguish human beings from other animals. Because, you know, there has to be something about human beings that's different. And he decided, well, okay, human beings have free will, and we can't smell very well. And so for 150 years...
Really, the digits don't give away the
Well, the animals can make jokes, animals can use tools, all those things, but we have free will and a poor
sense
of smell.
And Tony, they do make jokes better than us.
I have seen... Well, let's face it, if making a joke includes with, like, the monkeys, you're able to throw your own poop... You got to say, you've got a lot more leeway in making jokes than I have when I'm making jokes.
I don't have that kind of leeway on this show.
I know, you're the co-host. I'm the host. Never mind. That doesn't work for me at all. In 1879, he divided animals into two groups. Broca did. Osmatics, which animals that use smell as their primary sense, and non-osmatics, whose primary sense was not smell. And he categorized human beings as non-osmatics, not because we couldn't smell, because he thought we could choose whether to respond to a given smell. Now, being around Rick, I can tell you there is no free will when you choose whether or not to respond to a smell. That's not true. But other researchers have perpetuated this thing, and we have, in general, the idea we have a weak sense of smell. There's a scientist named John McGann, Rutgers University, published in the journal Science. He said that comparison's flawed. Our olfactory bulb, the part of our brain that deals with smell, might be relatively small, 0.01%. If you look at a mouse, they've got 2% of their brain dealing with smell. But since our brain is so large, particularly mine, since it is so large, we actually have more neurons The size of it is four times as large as a mouse, and we have the same number of neurons as the mice, the star-nosed moles, and some other things devoted to smell. So, in fact, we've got a pretty large part of our brain that is devoted to smell. He reviewed some research. We can discern billions of scents, and in my household, on a daily basis. Yeah, wait. This is better. Another study found humans are capable of tracking a scent trail of chocolate outdoors in a manner similar to dogs. My wife, by the way, could easily find a lost chocolate bar, even after it had been out over the weekend in the rain.
So I'm going to give you the opportunity here to live through the weekend. Can you expand on that and add some clarity? Are you saying that your wife's sense of smell is so good, or that she loves chocolate so much?
Yes.
Are you saying that she's actually more concerned about that chocolate? Never mind. You're dead. We don't have to do a show next week. It's going to be great.
Humans are more sensitive than rats or monkeys to certain smells. They're worse at other scents. The chemical has a banana odor. It's called amyl acetate. We're better. We're as good as dogs at sniffing amyl acetate. That did not come out right.
Yeah, so you got to make sure you get those words right.
Yeah. Oh, we got to get the bananas here. But we can smell bananas as well as dogs can. We're better than mice at sniffing out a scent found in human blood. So, in fact, we have pretty decent olfactory problems. The thing is, and this is what McGann said, and here, this is why Health Matters was created in the first place. This is less about how well we can smell is how can so many scientists for so long just simply said, yeah, human beings can't smell, even though we have very little research that actually says that. And I think questioning the established values of research is exactly why we've created Health Matters.
I thought it was initially to sell things.
Did you say sell things or smell things? Because, frankly, it could be either one. Either one's pretty accurate.
Well, I mean, I think if you date back to the original origins of Health Matters, you'll find that we were a marketing show.
Oh, that's true. I see where you're going with that. Yeah, at one time, Health Matters, before Rick and I signed on.
Well, let's be honest, we wouldn't sign on until they ditched the selling
stuff.
Yeah,
well, was to advertise.
We're not very good salesmen.
Services from area hospitals.
We're good smellers, though.
I can create a smell that, like, nobody's business.
I hate to say this, and Francis, I apologize in advance. We'd be pretty good because, you know, I'm probably the same way with peanut butter. So between the two of us, we could find a Reese's cup.
Yeah. I like that. It's kind of a team smell of fun. But it is a question. All right, so if you make, I don't know how you make a chocolate trail. That's the other thing that kind of intrigued me. How do you make
and how do you know
trail?
It's a chocolate trail?
Well, you smell it, of course.
That's going to look real good on video.
Oops, not a chocolate trail. Not a chocolate trail.
Boy, did we get this one wrong.
Yeah, okay.
There's no candy bar at the end of this trail.
I know.
You're going to try to get something in 40 seconds.
Right.
You're terrible.
Just one thing. Harvard Business Review, May 10th. Cornell University, Vanessa Bonds.
You got 30 seconds.
I know. She said that a request, she had people make a request from 200 people by email, six people you knew in person. Turned out you would get the same response rate. We're going to talk more about email, distrust of email, changes in email, and ransomware in our second fractional portion. So you can look forward to that. Rick and I are going to clear our olfactory palate and come back with our second fractional portion. You meanwhile, take a break, come back and listen and see if we can't do better than this.
You're listening. Find your chocolate trail.
It'll lead you back to us. You're listening to Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Waving Goodbye to Brian Courtney show. Unfortunately, we let Brian Courtney get off the air and out of the studio without making fun of him, so we had to come back.
Can we rename it to, like, the Chocolate Bar and Brian Courtney show?
May Brian follow his chocolate trails wherever
off
they lead.
Off into the distance.
Thank our sponsor for the second time, Zika virus fun facts.
Oh, gosh.
Cue the music, maestro. The CDC, they wish to speak. Avoid mosquitoes and don't get Zika. We're doing our top 10 Zika virus fun facts. The Zika virus, again, a flavivirus. This is one that is transmitted through mosquitoes. Fun fact number two, these are the Aedes aegypti and albopictus mosquitoes. They can bite any time of day. They tend to hang around your back porch or dark areas around the house, and that's the problem. Sure, the truck can go through the neighborhood and spray, but if you step out on the back porch and get bit, that spray, unfortunately, is not going to help you as much. Insect repellents containing DEET, picaridin, and IR3535 are safe to use during pregnancy and safe to use at other times, and we recommend if you live in an area with mosquitoes. Keep in mind, we've got West Nile virus. We now have the chikungunya virus, which made some inroads into the Caribbean, but then has dropped off some, but still a problem. And Zika last summer was continuing to spread late into the summer, and we anticipate will pick up and cause problems again. Fun fact number three, the symptoms are mild. 80% of people infected with Zika virus have no symptoms. You might get fever, joint aches, or rash and itchy eyes for about a week. Hospitalization, very rare, but it can affect your unborn child, and this is why we are talking about it. Once someone's been infected with the Zika, it's very likely they'll be protected and unlikely that it will affect future pregnancies. Fun fact number four, CDC recommends all pregnant women consider postponing travel to areas in which the transmission of Zika virus remains active. And as of last summer, that included much of the Caribbean and the Gulf Coast of the United States was a possibility, although transmission was occurring in the state of Florida only. We did not have transmission in other states. If you went to the Caribbean and came back to the state, you could get Zika virus while you were in the Caribbean. But just going outdoors in the United States, there were a couple of places in Florida last summer where transmission occurred. Fun fact number five, men who have traveled to a place with a Zika virus travel notice should wait at least 6 months after travel or 6 months after their symptoms started if they get sick before trying to conceive. So if you are a male or someone you love is a male and you are trying to have a baby, if you went to an area of Zika virus, they recommend waiting 6 months before trying to conceive to allow the Zika virus to clear completely. Women should wait at least 8 weeks after travel or 8 weeks after symptoms before trying to get pregnant. Men keep the Zika virus longer than women, and that's the difference between the 6 months for men and the 8 weeks for women. Possible exposure to Zika virus defined as travel to or residence in an area of active Zika virus transmission or sex without a condom with a man who traveled or resided to an area of active transmission. Fun fact number seven, healthcare providers should query all pregnant women about recent travel. And if you are pregnant, let your healthcare provider know if you travel to the south where there are mosquitoes that might have Zikas. Or if you are in the Caribbean. And fun fact number eight, which is not so fun, there is no treatment for infection with the Zika virus beyond supportive care. And in most cases, that's perfectly fine. It is not a deadly virus, but unfortunately, you cannot clear it once you catch it. Now, we talked last time, Rick, about email. Cornell University, Harvard Business Review reported, actually the study was reported in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, a woman named Vanessa Bonds. She had a 200 recipient email blast and then asked 45 participants to each ask 10 strangers to complete a survey. Then they blasted 200 people with a survey and they figured out how many surveys were completed. It turned out if you ask 6 people to complete the survey, you will do as well as emailing 200 people if you ask them face to face.
Okay.
Now, there are a couple of reasons for this. One is, they talked about, is the personal nature of it. When I come up to you and I say, Rick, would you please do this survey? I seem pathetic. You have sympathy for me. I have empathy for you. We talk about why the survey might need to be completed. I answer any questions you've got. We make eye contact. I might smile at you. I know
not
I don't
you.
Usually.
But not you.
Sometimes I might. And then you think, I'll do this survey for Tony.
Right. Now, how many of these surveys have you personally done throughout the hospital over the years?
Oh, gee whiz. I've done two today. Yeah.
I was going to say lots. But you've always got a good survey walking around.
Right. But if you blast 200 surveys out by email, one, and this is really new, but people are afraid to click on the links.
Right.
I don't know if this is from Tony. Maybe somebody's commandeered his email and has sent all this stuff
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
And then secondly, even if I do believe that it comes from the right person, I'm not so sure I want to waste my time. If he can't even spend enough time to talk to me, he's just blasting out emails. And I look and I see 200 recipients on the thing. I'm thinking, he's just spraying this around. I'm not interested. So it turns out that it – and the interesting thing, if you think about it, let's say if you're asking – if you're trying to get a response rate there, you think, well, gee, if I could hit 200 people by email, that's going to be a lot better than asking everybody that has an office next door to me.
Nope.
No, it is not, in fact.
Because email is very impersonal, and it's certainly an asynchronous form of communication, right, meaning that it doesn't happen concurrently. Right.
Right.
So I can ignore it. And then, of course, Tony, how many times have you – well, I probably actually do respond to your emails most of the time.
But you have that ability just to not respond to emails.
Absolutely. Because ask me that ultimate question. How many do I get? As a professional, an administrative, you know, IT person, I get on a light day 400.
And so
Now this isn't the ones you delete that are spam, that are, you know, hey, I'm trying to sell a house, or, you know, go, you know, buy a Russian bride, or I mean, none of that, right? I don't get those at my work.
Surprised
email.
You know the topics of
I'm
all
just, I'm just hypothetically.
I know, but you seem
but
to
I'm
be
saying,
so intimately acquainted
in
with
my
spam.
Work email environment, I don't use my work email address on any kind of a public website. So I don't go hit Yahoo or
right.
Google search or whatever with my corporate email account. So it's very pristine, right? I might get 8 or 10 junk emails a week. Right. But so the 400 that come in are people like you asking me a question and to do a dang survey.
You got me. So you're not going to do the survey. Bond's advice, if your office runs on email and text-based communication, it's worth considering whether you could be a more effective communicator by having conversations in person. One, you get up off your desk, which Health Matters enthusiastically endorses getting off your desk, getting away from your desk.
Do you know one word you never type?
You ask these questions that just totally shut the show down.
They're totally relevant.
And
if you'll humor me here and
okay,
answer the question.
Do I know one word that I never type?
Yeah. But you would say it if you were with me. If you and I were having a conversation in person about your little evaluation.
Right.
Now, Tony, not everybody has this problem, but the majority of people on the planet have this problem.
See,
there's a word they would say.
Is this please and thank you? Is this your name? Is that I'm trying to anticipate your strategy.
I'm going
to
give you a hint.
I'm absolutely lost here.
Our
no.
radio producer normally edits them out of this show.
If you think we talk like human beings, that's because of some careful production values here at Morris State Public
I'm
radio.
Saying when you're in person, so there's awkwardness that people like to – you can actually look different. When you're typing your responses, you can actually
okay,
make
okay.
yourself sound different. So a lot of people prefer to communicate via email or via chat or text messaging.
Isn't there an emoticon I can stick in?
Nope.
At the end?
Oh, okay. Find one.
Okay.
There's not one. There's maybe a scratch in your head one, but you know that's a whole different thing.
I need that one desperately.
But I'm just saying. So I think we could do entire shows on communication because. Today, everybody wants to do it through a text message, through 144 characters, and, you know, humans did not evolve on 144 character conversations.
No.
And there's just something getting lost in today's communication.
And there are some emotions that can't be expressed that way, even if you're very good at it and you use all sorts of visuals. Now, perhaps I've read that the next generation is going to communicate with photographs instead of with words.
Has your
general.
Wife ever taken one of your text messages out of context or not been able to detect the...
All right.
The sentiment of the email, of the
Let
text.
Me tell you about my text message. I am a terrible typist. I can't use my thumbs. Do you use your thumbs?
Yes.
Okay. See, I can't. I really tried it, and I'm terrible at it. So I don't use my thumbs. So what I do is there's a word suggestion.
There's animals like you.
Yeah, I know. There's a word. Thank you. There's a word suggestion box
That's
there.
Usually not right.
Yeah, it's not right. But my job is I will type one or two
do you
letters.
Know what word it never suggests?
But I will type one or two letters, and whatever word comes up, I'll pick that word.
Right.
So
yep, that's what I mean.
For the first few months I had my new phone, every text message I sent to my wife started with "Hey, dude."
Hey, dude.
The tone was just stuck on hey, dude. And I said, well, that's close enough. You know, I don't have to say, you know, honey, sweetie, my
hey,
love of
dude.
My life. Hey, dude.
Hey,
so
dude.
So I started them all with hey, dude. And then it got hung up on the student union. I never typed the word student union, but it's always I'm at the student union. So I said, okay. So at any rate, you asked, does my wife ever get to confuse?
Were you staying studio? Were you staying studio?
I don't know. But it was student union, and I've been at the – I told her I was at the student union, and I'll be home in 5 minutes. That's what I would say.
So it's someplace
hey, dude,
within
I'm
a 5 minute
– I'll be home in 5 minutes.
It's 5 minute radius of your house.
I don't know. At any rate, no, that's a long answer. The short answer is, yeah, we have a difficulty communicating by text message. And especially just today, I dropped email and called a guy because I wasn't satisfied with the exchange of information.
So that is why I think you can get a better – slightly – I think you'll get the – well, you're saying you get six regardless. If you talk to 200 people, you'll get six, right?
Yeah.
And if you send 200 emails, you'll get six.
If you talk to 10 people, you get six. If you send 200 emails, you get six.
Yeah, but and I think for entirely different reasons.
Yeah, agreed. Now, let's explore those reasons, though, because this is where this starts to get important for healthcare. We're talking now, New York Times, May 15th, the ransomware attack. This would be about 10 days before our show hit, 200,000 computers, more than 150 countries affected by the WannaCry.
Correct. That's what it got titled
Encryption
as.
Ransomware.
Right.
First of all, UK, not affected.
We were in good shape.
Okay. And again, Rick has to, there are some parts of his job, and so I'm trying not to put him in an uncomfortable position.
Well, no, you're not. I mean, you know, we have security standards that we meet, and we do have, you know, thousands of servers, and so some of them publicly accessible, so we have to be concerned about that. But you know, one of the nice things at UK is we do employ, or you know, we have hardware firewalls, we have you know, security monitors that are actually sitting and watching for people that are scanning or doing bad things. And a couple of years ago, we bought some firewalls that we call them next generation. So what they do, Tony, is they look at the traffic going in and out, and rather than, you know, firewall rules used to say, okay, device A can talk to device B, like using this, like, you know, protocol, like say, you know, a telephone protocol or email protocol. I don't want to get all technical. So it allows that. The modern threat detection, the new intrusion protection systems, we call them IPS, the IPS systems monitor the traffic. They don't really care about the source and destination. They inspect the payload of the data flowing through, and if they see something that's malicious, they stop it right in its tracks. So we do have some, you know, pretty good methods to identify and prevent. That doesn't mean that we're always successful.
Now, this ransomware came out of the NSA. The National Security Agency, they looked at – I don't mean that they
didn't do it and they didn't get it. What they did was I think they – the tools to find it.
They found it.
They found that
you could do this, and then apparently someone got it from them, took
right.
it from them in some way, and it spread worldwide. There is – we'll call this the Health Matters hero of today's youth, the Health Matters hottie, is a person who uses the Twitter name MalwareTech who figured out a kill switch.
Right.
So this thing – infects out-of-date Microsoft software.
It uses a set exploit dating all the way back to XP.
Yeah, and it locks the computer down. It encrypts everything on the computer and holds it ransom. It was sent widely to computers all over Western Europe, the United States.
It was sent widely to email.
To email.
And people clicked on the link and downloaded it onto their system. Right, and then once it was kind of peer to peer. So once it kind of got a hold of some computers, it could look for others.
British officials said 48 of the Britain's 248 public health trusts had been affected. All but six had been restored to normal operations by the time we went to press with this show. So I got it. First of all, I will just tell you here's a 4-step plan to prevent ransomware attacks, which I don't think will work very well. But
let me guess the first one.
Back
up your data.
Absolutely. Step two, limit system access.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I would actually put keep your system up to date above that one.
Step three is filter your email, and this is obviously for IT professionals to put filters on. And then step four is keep a whitelist. You have a blacklist of bad sites. What instead they're recommending is keep a whitelist of good sites.
So most firewalls, when you walk down through a set of rules, right, you say, okay, read this rule and do this, read this rule and do this, read this rule and do this. And then the very last rule is deny everything, right? Yeah. So if you get past the rules, you know, if you don't match any of the rules on the way down, when you get to that last one, you're denied. And so that's what we call an implicit deny. So we also have implicit allows. So if you think about that, that means I get to the bottom of the rule set, and I've done whatever the rules say, and if I don't match a rule, then I allow.
Mm-hmm.
So a blacklist means I'm an implicit allow, and I'm saying you can't come in if you meet this blacklist.
Okay.
An implicit deny is saying I'm blocking everything, and only the things on the whitelist can get through. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's imposing greater limits.
Absolutely.
Now,
And any modern good firewall is an implicit deny.
Now, are you thinking that it is time to not allow email attachments since they seem to be the portal of entry?
No,
so
Tony. This is like saying we should outlaw chocolate to fix obesity, right? At some point, there has to be personal responsibility and there has to be education. We have to get people to understand how to use the tech in front of them. Email's not going away. Tech's not going away. Hackers aren't going away. You've got to look at things before you click on them. You got to understand what you're doing. That doesn't mean you turn the password off on your home router because somebody got locked out. You have to understand that you have to have a secure mindset. Otherwise, you're putting yourself in jeopardy. And we can't. There's no way to say you can't. You're going to stifle innovation as opposed to trying to grow as a society. To grow as a society, we have to embrace information technology. We have to. We can't just be ostriches in all this. We can't stick our head in the sand and say, protect me, please.
All right. And so we will have parts of society that embraces this technology.
And the rest of them will get ransomware.
Well, okay. And they won't. But is there some stuff, and this is where I'm headed with this, and we talked about it. I'm giving you fair warning. Is there things like health information? This has been a common method of attack. Lots of bright people such as yourself across the country have tried to protect hospitals. Information leaks out all the time.
And it's
passwords. Sometimes it's a laptop. But for whatever reason, it leaks out despite your best efforts. Is there information that is simply too important to put up in the cloud?
I'm sure there is. It's just not your health records. Right. I'm sure there's probably some secrets in the NSA or NASA or the government that we probably ought to make sure they're in some vault somewhere. But I don't know that that's necessarily your health records. Right. So your health records do represent one of the largest pots of money for hackers. And that is, it's not that they care whether you have cancer. It's not that they care whether you have, you know, certain disease or this or you're even of this demographic. They get the three things they need to get identity theft. And if you have, say, for instance, a Blue Cross Blue Shield or a good insurance carrier as opposed to Medicare or Medicaid, then you probably have a bank account somewhere with some cash in it. And I can actually divert your direct deposit. I can go figure out, you know, because you used your cat's name as your password. I mean, at that point, I have options to get to your money. And so those accounts in there are very valuable.
Take a break and come back and listen to the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. You have no idea of what just occurred at that break, but we are not going to subject you to it. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver.
It was pretty heated there, Tony. I haven't seen you get that heated in a while.
Well,
I thought you were going to hit me.
Would it do any good?
I think so. We're going to have to both just kind of agree to go down the same path and search for some chocolate.
To disagree. This is the waving goodbye to Brian Courtney show. We are saying goodbye to our former producer, Brian Courtney, because Brian has left us for
locked
we
out.
Have to say greener pastures or more chocolate or whatever. Our sponsor for the final time, the Zika virus fun facts. And, Rick, I've still got to sing the song. The CDC, they wish to speak of. Avoid mosquitoes and don't get Zika. Our top eight Zika virus fun facts. I actually trimmed them back just for you so you wouldn't have to listen to 10. Fun fact number one, it is a flavivirus. It is. It can be challenging to separate from other viruses, similarly because in a mild case of Zika virus, you get those muscle aches and joint aches, the same as the flu, the same as others. But it does have, like these other viruses, a real propensity to go to the nervous system. Fun fact number two, it's spread by mosquitoes, primarily in Latin America, but also in the southeastern United States. They bite mostly during the day, but they can bite at any times. DEET, Picaridin, and IR3535 mosquito repellents work perfectly fine. Fun fact number three, the symptoms are usually mild. Most people, 80% of the people, don't even know they have the infection. You may get some fever, joint aches, rash, and conjunctivitis. It can cause Guillain-Barré, which is where you get the virus in your spinal cord. You get inflammation in the spinal cord, and you are not able to move your legs and your arms, and it can get pretty serious. But in most cases, there is a complete recovery from that. The big problem.
That must be pretty scary.
It is terrifying. And it's an ascending paralysis. And so what happens is you notice numbness and inability to move your feet, and then it progresses to, and it stops at some point, but you don't know how far it's going to go. And sometimes people have been on breathing machines because of Guillain-Barré syndrome. It is not a fun thing. And Zika virus has a high rate, a higher than average rate of Guillain-Barré, even though overall it's a rare thing. Here's the thing, though. If you are pregnant and you get a Zika virus infection, oh my goodness, you may be paying for that many, many years down the road, because it can cause malformations. It can cause something called microcephaly. It can cause brain damage in your child and your unborn baby. So and whatever you do, do not take a chance with Zika virus while you're pregnant. Fun fact number four, the CDC recommends that all pregnant women consider postponing travel to areas in which the transmission of the Zika virus remains active. That is Central America, South America, around the Caribbean. It turns out last year, brief periods of time, there was active transmission in the state of Florida. We believe it will come to the Gulf Coast. We do not want you to be the person that finds that out. Fun fact number five, if a man has traveled to a place with Zika transmission, he should wait at least 6 months after travel to try to conceive with his partner. If a woman has traveled to a Zika virus active place, she should wait at least 8 weeks before trying to get pregnant. Fun fact number seven, healthcare providers should query all pregnant women about recent travel. If you have traveled to the southeast, to the Gulf Coast, or to the Caribbean, or Central South America, be sure and let your gynecologist or let your physician know if you are a pregnant woman. And then fun fact number eight, there is no treatment beyond supportive care, and in most cases, that is plenty fine for the adult that gets Zika virus. That's not where our problems lie. That's our sponsor, Zika Virus Fun Facts. Now, last time, Rick and I occasionally get irritated with Rick. I mean, he's wrong most of the time, but sometimes he is seriously wrong, and in this case, we have one of those times. I'll remind you, there was a massive, massive outbreak of ransomware, the WannaCry ransomware. This was the largest infestation of ransomware in the history of computer science. This thing, it did go through obsolete software that had not been updated properly, exploited a flaw originally discovered by the NSA, and unfortunately, someone stole it. Someone removed it from NSA and used it and sent it out. There was a wonderful young person named MalwareTech, a 22-year-old who found a kill switch and shut this thing down, but they will come back. They're like the sand people. They will come back in greater numbers. We think we've got a temporary fix, but the experts expect this will be back.
I'm sure it will.
Yeah. And if not this, others.
Right.
It's just the nature of this ransomware. So Rick and I have this argument. I'm saying that the web is not a safe place. And I think you would agree with that.
I absolutely agree with you.
I'm saying further that it may not be ready to contain things like healthcare records if it is not a safe place. And I just see them oozing out of hospital doors and out onto the internet all the time, being sold, being exploited, being used on a regular basis. So much so that hospitals with perfectly fine IT departments are buying insurance against data theft because they know they're going to have to pay government fines. HIPAA fines because they keep losing it. And so my point is we either need to make the internet safer, we need to sequester healthcare information, we need to go back to paper, which is a really odd thing for a guy like me to say, but at least entertain that. And Rick says, no, we need to, that's going to stifle innovation, it's going to stifle progress.
Well,
we need to allow that to happen.
So Tony, if I put it all back on paper, how's Google going to tell me where the viruses are? How's Google going to tell me where trends and big data are happening and how things are moving across the country? I mean, I certainly understand people's belief, and I'm not telling you that you have to go to school for 4 years to be an IT professional so that you can operate your home internet. I'm not saying that. I'm saying we've been using email a long time. What do you do when you get a telemarketer call your house? You know how to handle a telemarketer. You've figured out that whole phone thing. You can't just click a link on an email. You have to hover over it. You have to see where it's going to take you. And you have to realize that if it's got a lot of X's and Z's in it, it's probably not legit. Hey, you know what? You know what, Tony? You sent out 200 emails earlier and people didn't respond. If that person really wants you to take that, you know what they're going to do? They're going to send it again. So if you get an email and you don't trust it, delete it. If it's really important, somebody will send it again. If it's really important, they shouldn't be sending it an email. They should call you. So I think there are things we can do in how we deal with this. We have so many modern communication techniques in front of us and so many modern ways of doing things if we would just understand some of the basics. So maybe you're right. Maybe a hospital that doesn't understand the cloud and doesn't understand the security, and more importantly, they don't understand how to police the PCs that are going to be accessing that, then maybe they shouldn't put their data out there. But there's no reason that a company that takes the proper precautions, patches their systems, keeps up with the current security trends, and can take advantage of the innovation that exists in the cloud, including the cost savings, then why stop that?
I see with the smoke signals, we need to move on to the second item in this fractional portion. I would say one thing, Rick, and you and I think we'll agree on this. If you put an attachment, if you decide to put an attachment in an email, you need to explain it. Do not
Absolutely. Send
me a link with no explanation.
Absolutely.
I will never open that.
I totally agree with that. And, you know, we try at UK to never send an email out that has a link in it. I will write out the instructions for you and say, go to this website, click on this, and do this. I won't give you the link directly.
Next up, from May 11th, the European Society for Radiotherapy and Oncology, their 36th annual meeting in Vienna. Wouldn't you love to go to Vienna and go to a radiotherapy and oncology meeting?
Not really.
I know.
I mean, I'd like to go to Vienna, and I'd go for just about any reason.
Yeah, I think so.
That might even be one of them.
Stare out the window. This was a person named Katia Aguas, a radiation therapist. And she's in Brussels. She was using SpongeBob videos to help children get through radiation therapy. They said if you're being treated with radiotherapy, you come in for a treatment every weekday, 4 to 6 weeks. The children need to remain motionless during treatment. And you know how you keep children motionless during radiation treatments? General anesthesia. Yeah, you
do. That's about the only way.
I mean, you do general anesthesia. They have to keep the stomach empty for 6 hours before the treatment to get their general anesthesia. And so they ask, what if we let them watch a video, a SpongeBob video, or a video of their choice? Would they hold still without general anesthesia? They took 12 children, ages 1.5 to 6, treated them with radiotherapy. 6 were treated before a video projector was installed, and 6 were treated after. Before the video was available, everybody had to have general anesthesia. 5 out of 6 did. Once they got the video, only 2 out of 6. So you had 4 kids out of 6 that were able to maintain being motionless by simply watching videos. And I think this points out, you know, our feelings about videos in children, particularly under age 2.
Yeah,
a terrible idea. And above age 2, limiting their screen time. But here is a great, great use of videos. So I'm trying to embrace technology in this case. If you have to have your child be still, there is nothing like showing them a video to render a child motionless.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a great way to do it.
Yeah, and
it does that to me.
They mentioned. I will say, you know, I am surprised sometimes. I think when was the last time I moved? You know,
couch potato, man. I mean, they don't call them couch potatoes for nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. And here are the advantages. First, I mean, it's obvious you're using a video instead of anesthesia, but the children in general are less anxious.
Right.
You come in, general anesthesia, it's not like somebody sneaks up on you and suddenly gives it to you. They have to start IVs, and they have to talk to the children, and they have to administer the anesthetic and so forth. And that's not easy. So the children get anxious even with the anesthesia. Second, it saves a lot of time, obviously. Turn on the video, start the machine. And third, it saves a ton of money and no need for an anesthesiologist. Now, granted, they got 4 out of 6, so there's 2 out of 6 you're going to have the anesthesiologist. But if that anesthesiologist is only working a third of the children rather than all the children, it can make a lot of difference. So we enthusiastically, wholeheartedly endorse the technology that brings SpongeBob to the radiation therapy unit for these children, a lot more of a better way to make them lie still than a general anesthetic. As much as there have been times when I wanted access to a general anesthetic for my kids. I remember one time we were moving, and my daughter slept in the car while we drove. This is when we moved to Moorhead.
Right.
She slept in the car while we drove, and we were exhausted. Of course, we had packed this trailer. We were driving over the Appalachian Mountains, pulling a trailer behind a car.
Back in the 30s.
Yeah, this was before the interstate system spread across the land. And so we were absolutely exhausted, and my daughter was wide awake. But at any rate, my wife took one for the team and walked my daughter around the parking lot at 2 a.m. while I got enough sleep that we could
looking
finish
for
our
chocolate
trip. But anesthetics would have been handy. Had we had a SpongeBob, I don't know what happened. It might have been that we slept while our daughter watched SpongeBob. I don't know. But this
is
a great thing.
Do you think back then you would have even understood SpongeBob? Doesn't he require some, like, He has some complex
At that
humor.
Time, it was
there's
it was,
some really complex humor.
It was Bugs Bunny, and well, Bugs true. Bunny there were political references. And,
absolutely,
he imitated common movie characters, movie stars, and so forth. So, I don't know.
Anyway,
all right.
Fun.
Next up, another exciting development in technology. This is something. This is really something. May 16th. The journal was Microbiome, Columbia University, Mailman, which is a great name for, I guess, a guy named Mailman gave them a donation for their School of Public Health. But Columbia University has a Mailman School of Public Health, and I hope that a bunch of mailmen got together and gave a donation and started this. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about, they looked at gut bacteria in people with chronic fatigue syndrome. Chronic fatigue syndrome been very, very difficult to understand. People who were formerly active suddenly become much less active, tired all the time, diffuse muscle aches, just don't feel like doing what they do. They sleep a lot. They know that there's something different, but we can't find anything. So as we always do, we treat it with antidepressant medicines. When you don't know what's going on, give it a shot.
I thought you were going to say antibiotics.
Well, I might. But no,
double dose.
But at any rate, they looked, and there were certain intestinal bacterial species strongly associated with chronic fatigue syndrome. Their combined relative abundance appeared predictive of the diagnosis. So the theory that they're saying is, one, you could use the gut flora, the germs that grow in your colon, you could use their signature DNA imprint to determine if a person has chronic fatigue syndrome or some other illness in the future. This is not ready yet. But the other thing is, we might then be able to treat chronic fatigue syndrome not with antidepressant medicines, but rather with altering the germs that are growing in your colon. So we may be able to cure a disease that right now is poorly understood. We've got a lot of work to do on this, but it's kind of exciting. And I just to remind you, back last October in the journal BioResearch Open Access, they looked at these same colon germs and colorectal cancer. You know, we've talked about red meat, particularly processed meat, and Rick, you'll know that as geometric meat, meat that comes in cubes, cylinders, circles, spheres, that
type
of
symmetrical shapes.
Symmetrical shaped meat carries a higher risk of colon cancer. Well, why? Is it toxic? No, not really. It's meat. I mean, there are some toxins in it, but maybe what it does is it changes the germs in your gut, and the germs are toxic more than the meat is. So you grow a certain type of germ, you're going to get a certain response. You change over to a higher rate of colon cancer. So, again, we have two studies here indicating that the germs in your colon may affect your body's metabolism, and there is that gut-brain connection. They may be causing chronic fatigue. They may be affecting your rate of colon cancer. And you can see then we're on the verge of an understanding of diseases that we've not had before.
It's exciting.
It is extremely exciting having new cures or having new ways of treating and diagnosing conditions.
Hopefully they're not doing it all via email.
If someone leaks out the actual diagnosis, oh, never mind. It's not important.
Just like this show. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Sean Delaney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
just like the prescription medicine Ivocana, Health Matters is a prescription radio show used along with diet and exercise to lower blood sugar in adults with type 2 diabetes. Health Matters is not for people with type 1 diabetes or for people with diabetic ketoacidosis.
Women who listen to Health Matters may get infections in the diaper area. Talk to your doctor if you experience odor, discharge, which may be lumpy or look like cottage cheese, or diaper area itching.
Men who listen to Health Matters may also get a yeast infection of the diaper area, especially those with chronic conditions. Talk to your doctor if you experience redness, itching or swelling, rash, foul-smelling discharge, or pain in the diaper area.
Which you can smell, I will point out. Health Matters can cause some people to have dehydration. Due to the loss of body water and salt, dehydration may cause you to feel dizzy, faint, lightheaded, or weak, especially when you stand up.
You may be at a higher risk for dehydration if you have low blood pressure, take water pills, have kidney problems, or are 65 years old.
Now the FDA is alerting the public about safety results from an ongoing trial that showed Health Matters and Invokana both double the rate of toe and foot amputations among diabetics.
These preliminary results do not prove that Health Matters or Invokana caused the amputations, but are a cause for concern.
The FDA has added a black box warning to the Invokana package recommending that our show not be used in high-risk diabetics and that diabetic patients be made aware of the risk of amputation with Health Matters and Invokana. Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, keep a close eye on your toes, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.